All right, that brings us to Fernandez Minette versus U.S. Attorney General. And we will hear first from Mr. Militello.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court, Ross Militello on behalf of the petitioner, Mr. Alejandro Fernandez Minette. There are two independent grounds for remand that I'd like to address. First one is the agency's failure to conduct a pattern and practice analysis as required by 8 CFR 1208.13b2 3 Romanet. And the second one is the agency's failure to enforce the Department of Homeland Security's threshold burden in removal proceedings to prove alienage pursuant 8 CFR section 1240.8c. After the parties completed briefing in this instant case, the court published Martinez v. U.S. Attorney General 992 Federal 3rd 1283, which governs this incident case, I believe. Just like Martinez, the agency failed to conduct a pattern and practice analysis when they ignored material evidence and disregarded parts of that applicant's claim. In Martinez, this court found such error to be indicative and proof of the agency's failure to give reasoned consideration to this element of asylum eligibility. Petitioner has, in this case, similar to Martinez, alleged that the agency failed to review the evidence of his claim of pattern and practice.
Counsel, you've alleged that to us, but you didn't raise that before the BIA, did you?
I didn't know. Well, actually, Your Honor, I do believe he did. I believe the one thing he did do before the BIA was press upon the board that there actually were reasons related to his political opinion as to why he would be persecuted in the future. In the transcript.
And you think that's enough to raise pattern and practice?
I believe so. I don't think this court should limit it to a recitation of the words pattern and practice. I think especially with
approach. Do you have a supporting decision that's sufficient?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the court said that exhaustion doesn't require a full briefing on the issue, but simply that the issue is raised and it gives the board an opportunity to weigh in on the issue. I believe that was expressed in
so we look
in
at the
and in Rawani.
So we look at the board record and determine whether or not that was sufficient to bring it to the attention of the board.
Yes, Your Honor. I think you look at the board record. I think you look at the notice of appeal, where he's even providing even more. He's even providing reasons that the immigration judge never got to. That was in his statement provided to the court, and also in a lot of the corroborating evidence that was completely ignored. That he was a member of a political party, or was he was perceived to be a member of a political party, an opposition political party in Cuba. All that was ignored, and all of that was his attempt to make the claim that, you know, in the future he's going to be persecuted. Because like other people who are dissidents against the government on political issues, who are perceived to be part of UNPACU, who even in his case, he was raised and never addressed right at the end when they're talking about internal relocation, that he is of Asian heritage. I know that there's no evidence in the record of his face, but having been somebody who's met the man via televideo, he is one of the individuals in Cuba who is of mixed race heritage and is part Chinese, I believe, according to him. So that issue was completely not addressed, and he continually raised it to the immigration judge, to the board. And at the end of the day, Your Honor, he is a pro se asylum respondent, and there's no, the immigration judge has to go through his own regulations and see that this is one of the material aspects of an asylum claim. He's explaining his fear of persecution in Cuba based on his political opinion, and the immigration judge, you know, who's supposed to have, who the agency gets all this deference because of agency expertise. Well, their expertise is part and parcel, part of the country conditions in these countries people are applying for asylum from. And to require exhaustion to be something that is requires a detained pro se asylum applicant to be able to read read the regulations, understand the regulations, and call the regulations to the attention of the immigration judge, who's ostensibly doing this several times a day. To have him then go do that to the board as well on briefing it seems to be a too strong a reading of the exhaustion statute. It couldn't have been Congress's intent when they put the exhaustion statute in into 1252. That would just essentially, if you don't give them attorneys and you detain them in rural Georgia far from attorneys, and you do their cases within 4 or 5 months of them even being detained and shipped across the country, if you have that additional requirement that they need to be able to litigate at the same level as the agency, it just creates the system where the regulations don't mean anything. And
what's your best authority or decision for the proposition that there's a different standard of review or a different requirement for raising issues before the BIA for a pro se petitioner as opposed to a counsel?
Well, this court's jurisprudence about exhaustion, you talk about, the court talks about if there's no excuse, if there's no, it's not a blanket bar.
Yeah. But was that a case in which there was a pro se petitioner and you said we wouldn't, and the court said that might not have cut it for somebody represented by counsel, but we're going to allow it because this guy didn't have an attorney?
No, I think that was Amaya, Your Honor. And Amaya,
I didn't see any of that in your brief, and I was asking if you had some authority.
No, Your Honor. I think the difference there is Amaya I believe he was pro se when he, and then for the first time alleged a due process violation as the judge had bias against me. He did that for the first time within the 11th Circuit. He wasn't identifying any particular term of art or any particular regulation that was violated, that something a lawyer would do or that the agency experts would do. He was saying something kind of the due process violation, a fundamental fairness problem that was just kind of general. And I think there, you don't need any special, there's no agency expertise in fairness, whether evidence is relative and probative. That's not part of their expertise. They get deference on that because they're fact finders. The pattern and practice and asylum law and the application of their regulations, that's really within the wheelhouse of the agency. And to, you know, I know there's in this court, not any direct precedent saying that a pro se person before the board gets any leniency on exhaustion, but there is an opening for the court to say that based on Amaya, and it's repeated statements that it's not a blanket bar to exhaustion. Exhaustion is not a blanket bar to raising claims that weren't raised previously.
I have a question about the record, Mr. Militello. What happened with the documentary evidence that the petitioner tried to submit? Did that make it into the record?
I have no idea, Your Honor. I have as much review of the administrative record as the court does. I wasn't his attorney at the immigration judge at the trial court or at the Board of Immigration Appeals.
You're familiar with the record, of course.
Yes, I've seen the administrative record, but it's disjointed. It's out of chronological order. It's not clear what was marked. The immigration judge never marked the stuff. He only marked the I-589, the form, and the NTA, which is, two exhibits in an asylum hearing being marked. It's pretty clear evidence that he didn't review the record.
You don't know if it's in the record or not.
Well, it's in the administrative record. So it's before this court that the agency reviewed it. Otherwise, the agency wouldn't have put it in the certified administrative record. When it got in there, I don't know. The respondent might be able to answer that better than I can, especially because they were the ones that received the certified administrative record and maybe have insight on how it was compiled. But as far as I know, it was before the agency. The agency just never reviewed it. Which is our argument. Now, if it's, well, we put it in the admin record, but it wasn't actually in the record. We just put it in the administrative record now, but it really wasn't before the agency. I wouldn't know how to address that myself, Your Honor, without knowing exactly if that's the case. It's never been asserted that these documents weren't actually before the agency, even though we included them in certified administrative record to this court.
All right, counsel, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from Ms. Leach.
Yes.
Good morning, may it please the court. Abigail Leach for the Attorney General. So I would like to start by first pointing out the pattern and practice claim was not exhausted before the agency, and it should have been exhausted before the agency. As opposing counsel just stated, the pattern or practice and the development of the record is within the wheelhouse of the agency. Accordingly, where the board, this court has held, where the board can provide a remedy, it should be raised on appeal to the board. Secondarily, the documents are in the record. They are stamped as being received on November 19th, 2019, and I believe they begin at page 203 in the record, maybe around there, 203 and 204. But those are the ones during his immigration proceedings that he said he had submitted in support of his bond, and they had nothing to do with his claim for relief or protection before the immigration judge.
Counsel, can I direct your attention to a different issue? We have some case law in our circuit where we have found that where there's a credible death threat by a person who has the immediate ability to act on it, that constitutes persecution. And in this case, there are several times when the petitioner said that it was threatened to him that he would be disappeared, which seems to me to be a death threat. And not only to him, but to his mother, I guess, after he left. And I'm wondering, it seems to me that the IJ found him credible. So why wouldn't that then be something that we have to consider when we're determining whether there was persecution? It also appears that although the IJ noted this in the facts, the IJ did not specifically discuss this issue.
I believe Your Honor is referring to the case of Diallo with the credible threats being able to be immediately carried out. In that case, the petitioner was at a meeting for the opposing political party that he attended with his father and his brother when the opposing political party guards, armed guards, broke up the meeting and began to arrest the people that were at the meeting when a fight broke out, and then the armed guards began shooting people. One of those people was petitioner's brother. Thereafter, petitioner was beaten and held and then threatened and told that he would be killed in the morning after being registered and listed. Here, petitioner was arrested and detained for a number of days, and then he was released with a warning and a threat of disappearance. And that happened on two occasions. He didn't suffer any serious injury. And this court has jurisprudence, and I believe in Renata Gonzalez, that says, without any evidence in the record to show that those threats of death could be had any intention of being carried out, that doesn't establish persecution. That's in contrast to Diallo, where
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to make sure I understand. I mean, the problem here is the IJ doesn't say that there's no evidence that these threats were intended to be carried out. In fact, he finds that the petitioner had a subjective fear that they would be carried out. And he doesn't say anything about, you know, whether he doesn't talk at all in his discussion about these death threats. Isn't that an issue here? Is there some reason why we shouldn't send it back to him to address how the death threats factor into the totality of the circumstances?
I would put that toward the well-founded fear argument. And here, petitioner testified that there's no outstanding warrant, there's no outstanding criminal charges, there's no evidence in the record whatsoever to show that anybody is still looking for him to target him for persecution upon his return, although he did receive the threats in the past. And in fact, he testified being able to leave Cuba on his own passport by presenting himself at the airport and leaving legally. So there really is no evidence in the record to show that he established an objectively reasonable fear of future harm to show that he himself would be singled out for persecution in the future should he return to Cuba. And with respect to his past persecution claim, again, he did not suffer serious injury.
I have one question about that. I thought that the IJ addressed only past persecution and did not address future persecution, but maybe I missed it. Where in the record did he talk about future persecution?
The board discussed that, the board affirmed the immigration judge's finding that he failed to establish a well-founded fear of future persecution on account of his political opinion. And they said that although that he did fear harm in the future, it was speculative and not supported by any record evidence. There was nothing in the record to show that he himself would be targeted for future harm.
And where did the IJ say that?
The board cites to the immigration judge's decision at 4. I don't have it right in front of me.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Okay. Again, to the extent petitioner argues in his opening brief that serious injury is not required, he misstates this court's jurisprudence to establish persecution. While serious injury is not required, this court does require a showing of threats combined with other forms of serious mistreatment. And to the extent petitioner cites to De Santa Maria, that petitioner, she was assaulted near her home. She was dragged out of her car by her hair. She was threatened a number of times. She was struck and beaten by individuals identifying themselves as opposition to the political party. She was traumatized by the torture and murder of her groundskeeper. So these are extenuating severe circumstances that are in addition to, although she did not establish serious harm, these are things that are combined as a totality with the threats of harm that she received. Those are not present in this case. Petitioner again was arrested on 2 occasions, although he did sustain a laceration to his head. He didn't require medical treatment for that, and he was released with a warning.
Why are you not discussing Martinez? There were threats that they would, quote, do unimaginable things to him. He would be tortured. Then on another occasion, he would threaten he could be tortured, jailed, or they could make him disappear. He had the aggravating circumstance of he was beaten, and the last blow caused him to fall, lose consciousness for a number of minutes, created a laceration on his head, so forth and so on. In all those circumstances, the panel held that that wasn't sufficient persecution.
And Your Honor, I was about to go there, so I appreciate you bringing it up. And so this case doesn't, although it's a similar fact pattern, the extenuating circumstances are just not present as they are in Martinez. He was seized by Cuban officials and detained for a number of days, threatened again with harm of disappearance. He was fired from 3 jobs, kicked out of a neighboring town. These are even more extenuating circumstances than petitioner has alleged or shown in either his case before the agency or in his opening brief to this court.
In this case, there's also evidence that while he was being detained, he was deprived of food and water, and that the police made threats to his family and also interfered with his livelihood by shutting down his sale of fruits and vegetables. How do we factor those elements into the analysis here?
Again, the economic, as this court described in Martinez, economic harassment does not constitute persecution as he was. Martinez was fired from 3 jobs as a waiter. And the threats to the family, again, there's no evidence that they would carry them out, but petitioner also received threats to his family as well in Martinez, and throughout and other cases this court has held that those that harm does not rise to the level of persecution. Substantial evidence supports the agency's finding that petitioner failed to establish harm in the past which rose to the requisite level of persecution, or that he established a well-founded fear of future persecution, and this court should then find substantial evidence holds upholds that finding. Where a petitioner fails to establish asylum on the merits and on the where the withholding of removal claim is based on the same facts, he necessarily also fails to meet his burden, as the claim for withholding of removal requires a higher burden of proof to establish eligibility for that relief. Similarly, petitioner failed to establish eligibility for cat protection, and the agency properly determined that he failed to establish it was more likely than not he would face torture if removed to Cuba. And this court should find that substantial upholds that decision. And just to return to the exhaustion requirement, the court lacks jurisdiction to review the petitioner's unexhausted assertion that the immigration judge violated his due process rights, where he failed to raise them in the first instance before the board, pursuant to 8 U.S.C. 1252 D1 and Amaya Artun Duaga. If the court doesn't have any other questions.
Counsel, I do actually, sorry. So I see that you're right, that the IJ did actually find that he hadn't shown an objectively reasonable fear of future harm. But what I don't really see is much of an explanation to explain why. And maybe you can help me with that.
The board explained that there's a lack of documentary evidence to support his speculation that anybody seeks to harm him. In order to establish a well-founded fear of future persecution, a petitioner is required to show both a subjective and an objective fear of future harm. In order to show an objective fear of future harm, they have to allege specific objective facts that are going to establish or show that petitioner has a good reason to fear that he will be harmed in the future, being targeted for harm. There's nothing in the record to show, other than petitioner's sincerely held belief that he will be harmed upon return. There's no documentary evidence to support his claim. So he did not establish a well-founded fear of future persecution in this case.
Where does the analysis of the IJ discuss this?
I don't have the immigration judge's opinion right in front of me, but I do see that the board cited to the opinion at 4. Again, this court reviews the immigration judge's and the board's decision to the extent the board adopts and affirms or adds to its own opinion. The court reviews both decisions. The attorney general requests that this court dismiss in part and deny in part the petition for review.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Militello.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the outset, I just want to bring to the court's attention that it's the case of Indrawadi. That's from 2015. It's precedent decision where the court found that a reason consideration, when the agency decision lacks reason consideration, that argument doesn't need to be exhausted to the agency. Much like what's been argued here, which is they've ignored evidence, they've not engaged in a whole part of the analysis that is required by law. These are things you can't raise ahead of time, otherwise you're requiring people to remind the agency of what its job is to do that day, and that's not what exhaustion requires. It's to raise any dispute about the issue. If the judge had found no pattern in practice and it wasn't contested, then that wouldn't have been exhausted, but there was just a complete absence of anybody addressing this individual's claim of future persecution. The agency completely just dismisses entire claim based on the fact that it found the harm in the past didn't rise to level of persecution, and then continued to call any idea of future persecution speculative, despite the evidence, despite his finding him credible, and they didn't do it without any reasoning, as it has been pointed out. That's the error that it was complained about in the opening brief, and that's the error this court needs to address and can, even if it finds it wasn't exhausted to the agency, because it's an issue that can't be exhausted to the agency. Additionally, I'd like to point out that the issue of the immigration judge not giving not requiring the department to sustain its burden in the beginning. These are also arguments that can't be made at that time by the applicant. If he's never given the rights, if he's never given advisals of the NTA, if he's never explained the process and the burdens and what's expected of him and the government, he has no ability to actually participate and have any of the rights afforded to him enforced. When a regulation is promulgated for the benefit of a defendant or in this case, an asylum applicant, and the government violates that regulation, it's presumed prejudicial. There's a reason the government put in these protections in the first place, and to just ignore them on an ad hoc basis is not only inappropriate, but it's a little frightening. Additionally, that error can't be exhausted, or that if that court finds that to be error, the only way to remedy this is to restore the petitioner to the position he was at the time the violation occurred, which was prior to pleadings being taken, prior to the NTA being sustained, and this court should order new removal proceedings to be conducted so that he has the actual opportunity to participate in his proceedings the way Congress and even the agency itself intended for him to be able to do. As to Judge Rosenbaum's points about harm rising to the level of persecution, I think there is an issue where if this court allows the board, because this court didn't say that that didn't rise to the level of persecution, it said it didn't compel a different result. So it's not that would never meet persecution, it's just that the agency didn't create any error. But by leaving the standard that flexible and allowing the agency to raise the standard of persecution that high, and then not requiring them to enforce their own regulations, 1208.13b2.3 Romanet, which is an affirmative obligation onto, if you read the plain language of the regulations, it's affirmative prohibition on the Attorney General to require evidence of being singled out for future persecution if there is a pattern and practice of people, of certain groups of people, and the applicant is a member of that group. If we don't require them to even do that on their own or to even include that in their decisions and then allow them to raise past the standard of persecution so high that it requires someone to go through years-long troubles and have people murdered close to them to be able to sustain a past persecution claim, and then future persecution requires being singled out, you're going to wind up deporting whole groups of people that would normally been covered by asylum law and the refugee protocols that came after the Holocaust. You know, the way I always look at my cases is if we're going to send back Jewish people to Nazi Germany because nothing's happened to them yet, and there's no evidence they're going to be singled out, that's an error in interpretation of the asylum laws, that Congress could not have intended such a result. And here, that's what would be happening if we apply what the agency did to my client.
Thank you, counsel. All right, I think we have your case, and we will be in recess for the rest of today.
Thank you, Your Honor.